From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Military science turned out to be the perfect subject for Mary Roach, who's already written about cadavers and sex in the human gut. It wasn't the military science of bombs and war strategy that interested her. She wanted to learn about the science that keeps soldiers alive. So as she puts it in her new book, The Parts No One Makes Movies About. The book is a salute to scientists in the military who work on the gadgets and systems and material that protects the men and women in uniform from explosions and heat and germs. This is the science that helps people in the chaos of combat cope with panic and the trauma of being disfigured. Mary Roach is joining us today. Her new book is called Grunt. Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Mary Roach describes herself as a goober with a flashlight, stumbling into corners and crannies, not looking for anything in specific, but knowing it when she's found it. And her offbeat subjects have included the human cadaver in a book called Stiff, the science of sex in a book called Bonk. Her latest was called Gulp, about digestion, basically. The new book, like others, is funny and irreverent, but it's also really moving at times and really intense, too, because the book is about the science of war. And the figure, of course, at the heart of all of this is the soldier, the grunt. Roach isn't so much interested in the bombs as the work that goes into protecting the grunts from the bombs. There's a massive complex of military science examining what a soldier wears and eats and sleeps on. The book is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And Mary Roach is joining us today to talk about the book. She's joining us from the studios of NPR member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Mary Roach, welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
So, I liked the description of you as a goober with a flashlight wandering around, and I'm trying to figure out what was the thing that got you started on this idea? Was it the bird thing, the chickens and the turkey vultures?
It wasn't the chicken gun. I was reporting, although I just like to used to say chicken gun whenever I can. The chicken gun.
Yeah.
I was reporting a story in India for the Smithsonian food issue on the Bhut Jolokia, the arguably hottest pepper in the world. And I learned in the process of reporting this story that the Indian Defense Ministry had weaponized, non-lethal weapon, this pepper. And I thought, well, I need to go over there and have a conversation about that particular angle on my topic. And so I made my way over there. And in fact, the chili pepper grenade was prone to mildew, yeah. So they didn't use it. But while I was there, they were testing a leech repellent. And I remember it's like, whoa, leech repellent. Yeah, I guess if you're wading through streams in monsoon season, that would be something that would be important to morale, to have something to repel leeches. And I thought, wow, military science seems more esoteric than I might have imagined, and maybe a little more roachable than I might have imagined. So that's what got me thinking along the lines of military science.
Did it surprise you how extensive it is? Because you mentioned in the book that you really can only cover a fraction of all this stuff.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, the military has a huge budget, so they do a lot of research. There's labs everywhere. There's a tremendous amount of everything from bioengineering to military entomology, whole branches of science that I had no idea existed. So that's very exciting to me, as to like a new set of laboratories to muck around in and make a pest of myself.
And getting into those labs, though, how complicated was that? This is the military.
Surprisingly, yeah. And I assumed that access would be problematic, to the extent that maybe I wouldn't even do this book. But in fact, the public affairs people were surprisingly helpful and willing to try to get somebody to say yes. They did. Sometimes the problem was finding the right person. Like, a lot of people would go, I'm not saying no, but I'm not the person who can say yes. So a lot of emails would bounce back and forth. Do we need AFRICOM? Is it CENTCOM? Is it the Pentagon? Is it the Office of the Secretary of Defense? Who's the person who has to sign off on this? So, but people were very, I think they were delighted to tell this story, because it isn't a story that gets told very much. And I there is actually a public affairs office for books at the Pentagon. They don't review your book. They don't really do much of anything except sort of take a look at your proposal and go, yeah, we're all right with that. And, and I thought you'd get like a stamped, sealed, like an official document with gold embossed lettering saying, we've sanctioned this. But no, it's like an email going, yeah, it's all right with us.
Yeah, nothing, you know, nothing classified in there.
Nothing classified in there. And that doesn't guarantee you access anywhere because it's up to the individual folks whether or not they want you coming onto a submarine or into a laboratory or whatever it is.
I don't want to give people they haven't read your other books. I don't want to give them a sense that the work that you do is necessarily frivolous in any way. But it is lighthearted and you have a kind of irreverence to it. And I wonder, I was not thrown off guard, but kind of surprised at how heartbreaking some of these stories are in this latest book. I mean, you are dealing with war, of course, and combat.
Right. Right. And that was something that gave me a certain amount of anxiety going into this project, because I know that it's war we're talking about, it, and it's soldiers and it's men and women who are putting their lives at risk and dealing with tremendous amount of discomfort and risk and danger. And, you know, I have never endured that. This is, you know, not really my world to goof around in, you know, I tread carefully. You know, there's humor in the book because it's me, tends to be more heavily, sprinkled in the, some of the historical chapters, the stink bomb and the shark repellent chapters, the OSS I felt could they don't exist
it.
Anymore.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And yeah, they had these delightful, formerly secret documents that I was looking through. So and some of the humor comes from poking fun at myself as the clueless outsider, the pogue, as they call it in the military.
Right.
The person who doesn't know what they're talking about because they've never been in combat. So I am, I'm a pogue. I'm not somebody who's experienced that fear and danger and risk and hardship. So yeah, I was very aware of, you know, of not being too, trying not to be too flip or irreverent. But it wasn't, I think the subject matter just sets the tone automatically. It wasn't like I had to restrain myself, like, oh, I feel like making a joke about your injury. No, I mean, it was very sobering and completely foreign to me to have to spend time with people who had been, you know, stepped on an IED and lost part of both legs. I mean, I've never spent time around that community of people, so it never crossed my mind to be jokey.
No.
Yeah.
You come back time and time again in almost all of the sections of the book to just the everyday experience of the, which is why Grunt is such a great title. It's the everyday experience of the sort of common soldier. And in some ways it's kind of inspiring. And to give you a sense of how much work this is and how much is involved and how hard this really is. I mean, that seemed like kind of an overwhelming theme in some way in the book.
Yeah, because it is overwhelming. I remember there was a set of body armor sitting on the ground. I was at a place near Camp Pendleton where they train Navy corpsmen who do medical care for the Marines, and it was a simulation they were having to do, you know, it was simulated combat, and they were going to have to provide emergency medical care, and they had to put on their body armor. And I remember just picking up the body armor. This is your outfit. It's not your backpack. It's not supposed to be like, you're not weightlifting here. You're just getting dressed, and I could barely lift it, and you're wearing that, and it's not the breathable fabric. This is, you know, it's Kevlar or the next generation of body armor, and it's heavy and it's not breathable, and then you've got a vest with your gear and your backpack and your weapon and your helmet, and it's hot. It's 110 plus, and you're working hard, and it's you know, I'm on book tour going, yeah, I only got 5 hours sleep.
right.
You know, it's incredible drudgery and hardship, and it's unbelievable that, you know, they get conditioned and used to it. You know, I was in a simulated, it's called a cook box. It's something over at the medical school where they were looking at heat injury and can we figure out ways to identify individuals who are prone to heat stroke and keep them out of extreme heat situations. So they had us, two Army Rangers and myself, on this treadmill in 100 degree heat. Right. And they put a backpack on me that weighed 30 pounds, which is, it's nothing.
Yeah.
It's nothing. And I lasted 7 minutes.
Yeah.
you know, just so it's, yeah, it was, it kind of brings it home in a way that movies don't. I mean, everyone's always running around in the movies and they're never really winded. And, you know, I mean, Mark Wahlberg always seems to be, you know.
Fine. Yeah.
Having a good day.
Right. I love the part about uniforms. Let's start there. Less an outfit, you say, than a system these days. But it's also an important part of morale. Talk about the importance of uniforms. This was great.
Yeah, I spent time at Natick Labs, which is a short name for a really long name that we can skip. But Natick Labs is everything a soldier wears or sleeps in or carries. It's body armor, it's food, kind of the accessories of being a soldier. And the uniform, there's a design studio for that where this woman who has a background in swimwear design and some other woman who'd worked at it was a Boston high-end wedding dress company.
Yeah.
Priscilla's, I think. So, you know, they have this background. And I thought, wow, that's kind of bizarre that you came from that to here. And she said, well, not really, because a swimsuit, it's a specialty garment for a specific function. It's high-tech fabric. And the garment has to move, and it's got to mesh with what the person wearing it is going to do, and which makes perfect sense. And so there's the design component of it, but there's an entire other lab where they're looking at flame resistance, mm-hmm. how to make a fabric that buys you a few seconds before it's going to burst into flame if you know you're close to an IED. There's also the folks who try to make the fabric repel everything that comes onto it in case of a chemical attack. So they're like looking at super shedding fabrics. And then all of these different treatments, they all have to kind of play together well. And there's the insect repellent treatment, and it's got to be breathable. It's got to come in under budget. It has to be something you can print camouflage onto, which some of the flame resistant ones weren't. So it's this surprisingly complicated undertaking for something that just kind of looks like, oh, it's just sort of walking around in these loose, baggy camouflage PJs. You know, you have no idea how high-tech the ACU, the you know, Army Combat Uniform, is.
You want to talk about the notorious orange-red underwear story?
Yeah, the orange-red underwear. This was when was this? Early 1900s.
Like 1908, I think it was.
Okay, 1908. Okay. So this was around this time, there was this idea in the medical literature that the color red would somehow kind of mystically equip you for heat and humidity, that you would be better off if your clothing were red, if your cap, your hat was the one that they supposedly the British in India had red hats, and this was helping them. So the U.S. military thought, okay, let's try this. And for some reason, they chose to do underwear, and they shipped off. They had all these red orange underwear made, and they shipped them off to these guys who were in the Philippines, and they said, try these out. Unfortunately, most of them were too small, and they were made of dungaree fabric, so they were really thick and hot, which is not any benefit of the red color is going to be outweighed by how heavy they were. And the color wasn't fast, so they were bleeding red, and these guys were mercilessly ridiculed, and they'd come in after the end of the study, and they had to give their opinions, and obviously the red orange underwear didn't make it into the military uniform of choice. So that it also it also faded to kind of this hideous cream color.
Right.
So yeah, it was an interesting chapter in military history.
There's a section you write about armoring up these vehicles, and which is more complicated than I would have figured. I mean, at first they're dealing with RPGs, and they kind of figure it out a little bit, but then you get these IEDs, and that's another matter altogether, and especially buried IEDs. And how do you deal with these big charges that are coming from below? Let's talk a little bit about this, because the complication you write about is you want to armor up a vehicle, but you can't make them too heavy or too bulky. They get super heavy if you go too far on this stuff. So it's kind of a balance they have to find, it seems like.
Right. And even before the IEDs, just RPGs were unanticipated, because the vehicles were Humvees. Some of them, you know, coming from out of Iraq, they were canvas doors. They weren't up to the task at all. And soldiers were doing this, you know, sort of just finding pieces of scrap metal and sandbags, trying to keep themselves safe. And then, you know, you start getting, you know, the military, because it's, you know, it's got the gear that it had from the last conflict, it scrambles to get some vehicles that will be protective.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the threat changes. You have an RPG, and like the stuff that stopped the rifle fire doesn't stop the RPG, and then figure out a way to stop the RPG, and then you go to the
RPG. The RPG
is going off.
The RPG is this shaped charge. You should explain it, because it sounds terrifying. It's packed with these.
It's kind of a double whammy.
Yeah,
shape charge. I mean, RPG is one of many different iterations of shape charges. But an RPG, it's shoulder launch. So the first blast launches it.
Yeah.
And then on impact with the target, the second charge goes off. And it goes, there's an explosive that goes off and propels this metal. This metal is shaped into a projectile that then pierces thick pieces of metal, the things that would stop rifle fire were not stopping those. It turned out the best solution turned out to be this. It's called slat armor, and it's kind of like taking livestock fencing with a very narrow gauge grating that went around the vehicle, and the RPGs would just get stuck, and it would sort of snuff the nose and prevent the blast from going. I've kind of dud the RPG.
Right.
So that worked pretty well, and they sort of come back looking like hedgehogs with things sticking out of them. But then the ID started happening, first on the side of the road and then eventually underneath. And really getting bigger, bigger and bigger. And the bottom of the vehicles were flat, so all of that energy and the seats were bolted to the floor. So all the energy is going right up into the feet and the pelvises and the spines of the people sitting in the vehicle, and to serious consequence. So figured out how you do a V-shaped hull that will sort of deflect it. Also, don't have the seats bolted, have them kind of floating on suspension.
Yeah.
So that helped. So, but then, the charges get bigger and they're actually breaking through the floor of the vehicle. So it's the enemies can change the threat, the weapon, much faster than the U.S. military can commission and test and build a resistant protective vehicle. I mean, that's a big undertaking, and it's a big lumbering bureaucracy, and stuff takes time, so they're always playing catch-up, playing cat and mouse.
One of the military scientists, and sort of this part of the book, is a woman by the name of Nicole Brockhoff, has this degree in biodefense, and shows you some of the sort of research, some of the experiments that they're doing, because conventional stuff doesn't work in combat situations. I mean, that's the thing that sort of came to me in this section of the book. Like airbags, you should try airbags. Well, they're not fast enough for a blast. Or you should try crash test dummies. Well, that doesn't really take into account the actual it's a different thing completely.
Right. Their automotive crash test dummies are designed for a head-on impact or a side impact.
Yeah.
They're not designed for force blasting up from right underneath you. And if you put one of those side by side with a cadaver on a blast rig and you set off an explosion underneath, it's like an old arthritic guy trying to follow along in a Zumba class. There's like there's no overlap. Like the feet on the dummy aren't. I mean, because the ankle and the feet don't bend the same way. The head is actually moving in a different direction. The arms don't move nearly as much as somebody who's been hit from whacked from underneath, who's sitting down. So, so they're trying to build a specific to underbody blast a crash test dummy called Wea Man, Warrior Injury Assessment Mannequin. So that's a project that's underway, and they're doing what the automotive industry did years and years ago in the 60s, systematically taking cadavers, going through and saying this kind of a blast, this kind of force would cause this sort of breakage of a foot, or documenting what each type of force would and energy would do to the human body, and then calibrating the dummy with that information. It takes a long time. It's going to go on for another year, and who knows where we'll be fighting in a year and what they'll be throwing at us. So they do their best, but it's a difficult undertaking.
The use of cadavers in these experiments, and they have these, this was so interesting, they have these form-fitting lycra costumes, which you sort of mentioned, is that these cadavers kind of have a superpower. So in some ways, there's something appropriate about the fact that they have these lycra form-fitting, colorful costumes.
Yeah,
but you do mention it was kind of controversial within the Pentagon at first, using these cadavers, at least in the early days, I guess.
It was. It's and I wanted to say when I described, there's a blast rig and there's an explosive that goes off underneath and the cadaver is in a seat above it. But it's not blown apart. It's strange. If you look at it in real time, it just looks like it took a speed bump too fast. Mm-hmm. It's only when you, and it's filmed in ultra high speeds, so when you see it very, very slow, it's like there's like 10,000 frames per second. But it's only when you watch it slowed down, when you see the arm is being flung beyond the range and at a speed that it can't cope with. It's if it were slowly extending its arm, it'd be fine. But it happens so fast that the tissue can't respond and it breaks. The arm will break, or there's a strain or whatever it is. The cadavers aren't blown apart.
Right.
But people don't know that if they haven't seen it. And there was someone at the Pentagon who felt that his or her personal ethics had been offended and stopped the experiment. They were actually wiring up a series of cadavers to do this work, really important work toward a good end and very justified use of someone who's donated their body to science. But someone came in and shut down the study at the last possible second. And the people working on the study were horrified, not just because they'd spent a lot of time and money on this, but the people who donated their bodies their bodies were going to go to waste. Because they were running up against the point at which decomposition would start to render the bodies not useful. They managed to get the thing back on track, now because of that, there's a multi-layered permission process that all the way up to Congress has to sign off that yes, it's okay. Anything that's destructive or explosive or involves a weapon, the person the donor has to the person who's donating the body needs to know. And it has to be approved on these many, many levels. It may take, I think they said, 6 months,
maybe
more. So that all has to happen because it's very, it's taxpayer dollars. It's called sensitive use. There's a sensitive use policy. You might think, well, who would volunteer for this? It's actually maybe people who have patriotic feelings, people who want to give back to the military, but probably just the same people who donate to an anatomy lab where you're cut up bit by bit and taken apart limb by limb.
Yeah.
You're dead. You don't care. You're the kind of person who wants to do something useful. So some people get that and they want to donate, and other people are kind of horrified by it. And that was what happened with the We a Man project a while back.
Mary Roach is with us. Her new book is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. We'll talk about military noise when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Mary Roach is back with us talking about her latest book called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. The book is not about the military science of guns and bombs. It's about the science used to keep soldiers alive and protected and the gadgets and techniques used to put them back together once they've been hurt. I wanted to ask about this. There's this chapter where you write the U.S. military, obviously, in particular, this branch is the Marine Corps. You say they buy a lot of earplugs, which makes sense. It's pretty noisy in the military, obviously. But here's the thing that I hadn't really thought of. You say combat earplugs aren't really helpful in when you need to hear a voice yelling at you to, duck or get down.
Yes.
So talk about military noise and how military science is dealing with this.
Yeah, it's kind of a conundrum because it's easy to protect ears by putting in earplugs or heavy-duty hearing muffs over your head. But it's you can protect the ears, but you're also losing situational awareness is the term they like to use in the military. So it's something like 60% of your situational awareness, whether you're in combat or you're riding a bike down the street, is coming from sound. And people in the Marine Corps, the Special Operations Army, wherever, the feeling is, I would rather save my life than save my hearing. And there's a tremendous amount of hearing loss. It's $1 billion a year in VA disability, and it's very, very prevalent. And it's not just bombs and bullets, which are very, very loud, but it's a very short span of time. And hearing loss depends on how long you're exposed. Yeah. Sometimes it's the transport, whether it's a helicopter or a Bradley personnel carrier clattering along. It's very loud, and it's a long chunk of time. So you'd want to be wearing hearing protection. But then if things go kinetic, as they say, if people start shooting or firing, you want to know what's going on. Also, you're not going to wear the stuff for the entire 8 hours waiting for the moment, the few seconds where there's loud noise because they're hot and uncomfortable. So that's the conundrum. That's the problem. And I spent some time with some folks from I think there was 3M had made the device. It's called TCAPS,
right.
Tactical
communication and protection. I've got it written down here. It's
system.
Not like I know.
Thank you.
Yes.
Tactical
communication and protection.
That's good. I was impressed.
Yes. How much does one of those suckers cost? By the way, they must be crazy.
I don't know. I'm not sure what they cost, but I should tell people what they do.
Yeah, please.
Which is it's kind of a cool thing. They attenuate. They dampen a very loud noise. It's a system that recognizes loud versus quiet sounds, and it dampens the very loud ones, and it amplifies the quiet ones. And there's a communication system built in, so you can be communicating with people far, even up like in a helicopter overhead. So despite this chaos going on around you, you can still communicate with the other people in your unit. So right now it isn't throughout the military. It's most special operations has the TCAP system, and there's folks who are trying to get this, make this available for more of the troops on the ground.
There's this you go on this listening exercise in this part of the sort of research of the book, and you're in this sort of special operations team going into this simulated, I guess, village in Afghanistan or something like that. And it really seems pretty intense. Are you wearing the TCAP system when you're going through this?
We're wearing the TCAP system. And it was an interesting combination of folks because it was this Marine Corps Special Operations group who were sort of leading the tactical scenario. Yeah. And it was out behind the firing range at Camp Pendleton and a group of military audiologists. And the idea was to kind of get show them this is the challenge. You know, we can't just put on heavy duty ear cuffs and be done with it. That there has to be a way to facilitate communication and situational awareness. So we all went out, and it was funny. We kind of lined a military audiologist and myself. And it was two people per special operations guy, and he was firing a weapon. There were gunshots going off. Yeah. We had to stay behind him. Whatever he would do, we would do. It was kind of like the bunny hop going on, but with large weapons involved.
The chapter turns out in part to be kind of about the trials of the hard of hearing. And one Marine, by the way, who had lost an arm and a leg in a blast, said the worst part was the hearing loss.
Yeah, because he said, I can't communicate with my family.
Yeah.
That's you think of hearing loss as kind of a minor. So you're a little hard of hearing. And after the exercise, we all went to dinner, and it was a loud room at Camp Pendleton. And I was sitting with a special operations guy named Jack, and he said, this is the hardest thing for us. And I was like, having people ask you questions about what it's like to be a sniper. Yeah. And he goes, being in a loud restaurant, he said, if you look around at these guys, you're going to see them kind of withdraw. And they're just going, because they can't hear a thing you're saying. Because these guys all have hearing loss by the time they leave the special operations. And there were some guys there who had hearing aids. And that's another thing a military audiologist do is fit 40-year-olds for hearing aids.
One of the injuries that you really... people don't really talk explicitly about are the injuries sustained to a person's genitals. And you have a whole chapter on this. You say that with advances in combat care, more and more men in particular, at least that's what you focus on here in the chapter, are surviving, and they need genital reconstruction.
Right.
Let me just talk about, was this a tough one to get people to talk about, first of all, this subject?
Surprisingly not. Huh. I contacted a surgeon, Jim Jezier at Walter Reed, and I said, I'd like to talk about this in the book because it's something that you don't hear much about. And part of the reasons you don't hear a lot about it is that, as you mentioned, for a long time, the explosions were smaller and the combat medical care wasn't as good or as fast, so you weren't having that many people surviving to need this work. So it didn't get a lot of coverage. It's also a smaller number, like 300 injuries of this variety versus I think it was 18,000 limb amputations. So it's wow. It's a smaller population, but it isn't mentioned that much. And I wanted to cover it because it's, you know, it's a devastating thing. And Dr. Jezier said, yeah, you can come into the operating room. I'll have to ask the patient. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, there's no way.
Yeah.
And this gentleman who was a combat engineer who'd stepped in an IED, and he's like, yeah. Sure, if she wants to come in to the OR, watch my urethra be reconstructed, whatever her thing is, that's fine. No, people, they were very, very, I think because it's, you know, that's, he's a urological surgeon who was in Iraq, possibly in Afghanistan as well. But anyway, it's his daily job. So it wasn't, to him, it was not like a, oh, this is a taboo. It was just, yeah, this happens and it's awful and this is what I do.
There's this really powerful section that you write about, and this is with this Captain Gavin White, and you explain what happens to him in this when they're attacked, and his penis was damaged, and while all of this is going on, he keeps his head, he's concerned about his men, and it's something that you obviously think about and you worry about, and in the back of his mind, you know, he's thinking, what's happened to my penis? And he says this, and I'll just use sort of a strong word here. He says, if my dick is gone, just leave me here to the medics.
Yeah.
And
he
was only half joking. Would you just talk about that? Because this is a really powerful part of the book.
Sure. He said, I mean, this was after, you know, he stepped on an IED, the part of one leg and the back of the calf on the other leg had been blown off, and he could see at a glance that there'd been some damage to his penis. Yeah. And his priority the whole time, he's like keeps trying to get up and say, who's hit? Because he's the commander. He's like, right. Who's hit? And the medic keeps saying, it's just you, sir. It's just you. You know, stop trying to get, they had to like tie him down. And you know, you hear people say, oh, the first thing that goes through someone's mind is, oh, is my junk okay?
Yeah.
And he's like, that wasn't the first thing I was like, but over time, because it took a while for the medevac to get there, you know, he put on his tourniquets himself, and then he's got some time to think about it. The fact that, and he can't, they've tied him down so he won't keep getting up. So for better or worse, he can't really inspect the damage. And he's like, I haven't had kids. If I, that's what he said. He's like, I was half joking because I haven't had kids and I want to have something to do that with. And so, yeah, I mean, that's obviously a big concern. He's got other concerns. His pelvis is actually cracked.
Of
I mean,
course.
He's in danger of dying. So that's also, and he's in a fair amount of pain. But all of this is going on. And his concern is, you know, who's hit? Who's okay? And that kind of blew my mind because it's the kind of, you know, you imagine that kind of instinct to protect among parents and children, you know, a flaming building, running in to get a child. But that connection between men in a unit in a combat situation is something I'd never experienced, and it was really moving.
The bonding of combat, you write about the instinct of duty. Again, this is a mm-hmm. really important part of the story. I guess one of the things also that comes up, at least in this part of the story, the question, is it fixable? And this part was really interesting. I mean, you write about how you can use the skin from, for example, a forearm or the skin from behind your ear to rebuild a urethra. But the problem with that is it doesn't do well with liquid like urine, you know, and mm-hmm. The skin inside the mouth can.
Did
we say something about that? That was
right.
So interesting.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the skin on the underside of the arm or behind the ear is good because it's hairless. That's excellent. You don't want, because hair, there's minerals in urine that would get sort of trapped and build up on hair, and then you could have sort of a stone that would be perhaps a blockage or break loose, cause pain. So that's, you don't want hair. You don't want hair on your urethra.
Yeah, right.
Perhaps aesthetic too. I don't know. But this is tissue that's not designed to be moist all the time. But the inside of the cheek, someone figured out. I don't know who's the first person who figured this out. But like, hey, why don't we take a stretch, a rectangle of urethra, and stitch that in place and roll it up, make a tube out of it, and that works really well as to patch a urethra that's been damaged, which you come into this. I mean, I came into the OR and here's a patient who's having work done on his pelvic region, but they've got his, you know, they're working on his face. I'm like, what? They're going into his mouth. I mean, it was a fascinating. And then there's like just things you would never, or I would never think about when you're doing surgery on the penis and you've got things stitched. You have to blunt erections because that is painful and it pulls on the, you know, it pulls the tissue apart. Just these things you, I don't know, not as someone who doesn't spend my days doing surgery on penises would never have thought about, but just really so interesting to me anyway.
Hey, Mary, do snipers shoot at the groin? Do they shoot at the genitals?
I asked Dr. Jezier that very question because he was showing me some of the patients kind of like how they were when they'd come in and how he had repaired the damage and what you can and can't do. And I asked him, did this sniper intentionally shoot at this man's genitals? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you do hear stories from World War II as well. And then there's a military historian, Dale Smith, there at the medical school, USIS's Uniform Services University of the Health Sciences. Anyway, he said there's not really any hard and fast evidence. And the thing about a sniper that's there is a secondary goal of bestowing fear on sort of mass fear, like this is something that they're doing, but they're really there to take out somebody. And a shot to the groin is not a kill shot. It's not a guaranteed kill shot. So he said, you hear stories. I don't know that it's true. I suppose there probably are individuals that do that.
Yeah. Mary Roach is with us. Her book is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And we'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Mary Roach. We're talking about our latest book. It's called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. So let's talk about stress inoculation. There's this great section where you are basically describing how it is military science helps medics in particular cope with the chaos of combat. And it's interesting, you say in the book that you had your own version of stress inoculation when you're reporting on killer bees. So maybe tell that story to give us a sense of what that is exactly.
Sure. Well, the idea behind stress inoculation is that if you're exposed to a lesser version of something upsetting and stressful, or a controlled version of that, that then when you go and experience the real thing, you'll be better able to cope. Yeah. I kind of experienced a reverse version of that in that I was reporting a story on killer bees, and I had chosen a bee suit that was kind of old-timey and Catherine Hepburn in African Queen, and it wasn't the high-tech lollipop head version. I'm like, no, I want that one with the pith helmet with the veil. Right. They're like, okay. So and of course, I didn't tie it right, and we're in this. It's killer bees, Africanized bees. It's the same venom, but they're much more aggressive. Yeah. And the bigger the hive, the more aggressive. So it's this big 50-gallon oil drum hive out on this farmer's land. And we're in there, just this like whirling cloud of angry bees. And my veil has come somewhat undone. And bees are getting in to my and are flying around my face. And I'm having to hit my face to kill them. And I was stung a few times. And it was kind of an intense traumatic situation. And there's one guy, there was an emergency medicine guy going, do you think you're allergic? You may be allergic. How are you doing? Are you having any shortness of breath? And I'm just smacking my face and I'm like, ah. And so then later in the afternoon, we go to this farmer who uses honeybees for pollination and he's got a whole bunch of bees. And I look down and there are honeybees crawling on my arm, not Africanized, just regular honeybees, which is a situation that up until that day would have caused me to go,
right.
Bee. And it was like, yeah, honeybee, big deal. So kind of a reverse version of that would be what they try to do to train combat medics and Navy corpsmen who are do medical care for the Marines. There's this place, a big movie, former movie studio down near Camp Pendleton called Strategic Operations, and they do these hyper-realistic combat scenarios. And they really are pretty realistic to the point where they have amputee actors who've got a latex gore sleeve over their stump that is hooked up to a backpack with stage blood and a pump, and it is bleeding like an arterial bleed, and they're screaming, like, this guy's like, I'm not going to use its swear words, but screaming and grabbing the medic by the lapel, going, help me, help me, and their blood is pooling on the floor. Meanwhile, they've got pyrotechnics guy shooting off dud RPG rounds, and dust hits so it looks like rifle fire is hitting the ground, and they're playing full blast the soundtrack to Saving Private Ryan, I found out later. And I'm like, wait a minute, I've heard this, but wait, that's Tom Hanks. And these kids come in and they've got to render emergency medical care. They've got to put on a tourniquet or do a needle decompression on a guy wearing a cut suit, or he's got kind of a patient simulator. It's a wearable patient simulator. It's kind of a torso with organs and lungs, and
And they're falling out at
airway.
Times.
Yeah.
It's
so all
gross.
Of this it's quite intense and loud and chaotic, and the thing with a stress survival response or fight or flight is that all your blood is going to your extremity so you can run away or throw a rock at a bear or whatever you need to do. In the very early days of when people were stressed out, it was it tended to be predators and running away. And now
you're
these
fast,
guys, these,
strong and dumb.
Fast, strong, and dumb.
Yep.
Yes, exactly. So, and if you're rendering medical care in a combat scenario, you're dealing with complicated equipment. Sometimes fine motor skills you need. You need your brain. Mm-hmm. You don't want to. You need to be able to keep situational awareness, stay calm. I mean, so if the fight or flight response is working against you, and so the idea is that if these guys can do care on the amputee actor or the guy in the cut suit with their trainer yelling at them and gunfire, albeit fake, going off all around you, hopefully this will better prepare you to do the same thing in when the real deal happens.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard to evaluate how well does that work systematically in a study. I didn't really find a study that looked, a controlled study that would really look at how did this affect performance. But if you look at if you look at stress in surgery, stress definitely causes mistakes and errors in judgment and all the kinds of things that could happen in a combat scenario. So, it's just one of the ways that they try to prepare medical personnel to render care in this very extreme environment.
There's a kind of controversial practice here in this section that I wanted to mention briefly, even though it's kind of tough to hear. And this is the use of animals for what they call live tissue training. There's some legislation at work
animals,
to reduce the number of this, but it's maybe you should say something about that.
Sure. Since the Vietnam era, that's been one way that medical personnel have trained. It's an anesthetized pig or goat, and the leg will be the idea is to sever an artery, and so the person's going to come in and actually grab the artery and stop the flow, apply a tourniquet, save the life of this animal that is not ultimately going to go on to do anything else. So it's, anyway, as you can imagine, it's not popular with animal rights people. And the use of these very sophisticated cut suits and patient simulators has made it harder to defend that practice. But there are some who say, it's just always going to be different. A breathing creature, you're more in, you're understanding, the process of bleeding and stanching the flow, and anything that you're going to try, it's not quite the same on a patient simulator. But whether or not it's justified is open to debate. And yes, there's been a bill that was introduced that would cut down the number of animals used. I forget by when, but anyway, that's one of the things that is boosting sales of cut suits, because those are being used more now. And that's probably a good thing.
Right. This is a section on smell, which was really interesting. And it starts with this story of this operation in World War II to humiliate the enemy with these kind of low tech devices. We can talk a little bit about that in a moment. But, you know, the one thing that's interesting is I hadn't realized, because you mentioned in the book that olfaction, the importance of olfaction as being kind of the sensory security guard, that we really
– Yes.
That we're really in tune with stinky stuff.
Right, right. And to make an effective bad smells, there's the use that you mentioned, which is humiliating officers in occupied countries in World War II. But more recently, they've been used to clear a room, to keep people away or to disperse an angry mob. That's a more classic use of malodorants, as they're called, when they're used as a non-lethal weapon. And one of the reasons they're effective is one of the reasons you want to have a combination of foul odors is something that's not identifiable is scary. Because
right.
that's the point of one of the points of your sensory, your olfactory system is to warn you, you know, if there's smoke, this is danger. And something that's unknown, you can't say, oh, I know what that is and it's safe, I'm okay. If it's foreign and unplaceable, you're like, I don't know what this is, I'm getting out of here. Could be a chemical attack. It could be, I don't know, something off-gassing that's going to hurt me. So they would make a mixture in trying to make a non-lethal malodorant. They'd go for a bewildering foul smell because that was more effective. It also, this was cool. This was, they put a little top note that's in a Monell Center here in Philadelphia right now.
Yeah.
They'd add kind of a fruity, pleasant top note to encourage you. You know, you take the tentative sniff, oh, this isn't so bad, and then you take the keeper inhale, as
right.
they call it over at Monell, and you're like, ah! It's just a dastardly, very cleverly designed, hideous smell.
There was one part of this section I really loved. There's this materials engineer by the name of Bob Crane, and he's in the Air Force, and he comes up with this idea of somehow sending pleasant smells to the enemy to make them miss, you know, mom and her cooking
yes.
and home and stuff.
Yeah, he was a scientist who worked on microencapsulation. And one of the things you can encapsulate is an odor. Scratch and sniff is a form of microencapsulation. And he worked on this stuff for the Air Force. It had to do with microencapsulated paint that would indicate if somebody had stepped on a wing, it would sort of bruise. It was sort of a bruisable paint. Anyway, because this is what he did, he kind of thought about, you know, what would be some interesting uses for this? And he had this idea that you could encapsulate in these little tiny particles, the scent of fresh baked bread. And you could, you know, drop that overnight on an enemy position. And in the morning, they come out to do their exercising or whatever, and they step on these capsules and they get this whiff of homemade bread. And they're fed up and they're tired and they're hungry. And this would cause them to go, you know what? I'm out of here.
Right.
I'm going to desert. I'm going home. Say that just, you know, if that was the kind of weapon, would that we could just win wars with that kind of thing.
There's this section you write about sweat. It's great, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about it, but it gives you a sense of just how hard it is. Again, we were talking about this earlier, to be a soldier, how much work they do, how much weight they have to carry. And there's this really cool thing called a HULC, Human Universal Load Carrier. It's kind of this exoskeleton,
yeah.
which sounds
yeah.
super cool. You want to say something about that?
Sure. There's been prototypes of this for a while. Of this is like, well, what if we could have this sort of technology that with every step you would have this system that was carrying the load. It was taking the load off your frame and putting it onto its own frame. And the Hulk, it has been tested. And I came across a comment by one of the online of one of the people who had tested it. He was like, yeah. We were supposed to go, I think it was 87 pounds for a few miles. Well, after 45 minutes, we pretty much all had shin splints. So it's not there yet. But
right.
one of the things, also the battery life is in like 5 hours. And
yeah.
then what do you do with it? You got to like carry the carrying system.
Yeah.
But it one of the military people on those military technology websites pointed out that it would be incredibly useful if you were someone unloading supplies from a truck, like doing this repetitive motion of carrying, lifting a big box and moving it, like a system that a wearable system to help you that moves with you as you're lifting. Yeah, that would be a good use of that. But yeah, the videos of the Hulk, they kind of look like those old, like guys running with a rucksack with those old polio braces on their legs that you used to see in the 60s. I mean, it's you kind of, how could they get back up if they fell? I don't know. So there's a ways to go, it seems to me, but interesting efforts. Their heart is in the right place.
Yeah.
They're trying to make it a little less bruisingly awful to be carrying that kind of weight.
Well, we didn't get to diarrhea or the maggot paradox, but people can read the book to get that. I'll just titillate them with the chapter title there. I want to ask you finally, though. The military has this system that you write about toward the end of the book called feedback from the field, where these military researchers talk about a body that they see on the screen and break down what had happened and how the person died and all those kinds of things. And you write about how the autopsy photographers have to get up really high to see the whole body, to get it in the frame. And you mentioned that war is kind of like that. Would you say something about that finally, the idea of perspective that you drew from that?
Sure. I was walking through it's this large autopsy room at the morgue in Dover Air Force Base, where there's the mortuary and the morgue. And I saw it's this big platformed stepladder like you would imagine Michelangelo using. And I said, is someone painting the ceiling here? And he said, no, that's for the photographers so that they can get some perspective. And I just ended up saying, that war is kind of like that. When you have to step back, it's one of those thousand points of light that only when you step back and you see the whole thing could you perhaps see the justification for extinguishing any one of those lights. But I was saying that in that room, in the autopsy room, it was really hard to get that perspective, and it was kind of hard to imagine a stepladder that would be high enough.
Mary Roach. Her new book is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Mary, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, you bet. Thank you so much, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.